From WXXI News, I'm Michelle Faust, and this is Connections. Evan Dawson is out today. Today, our connection goes back to May, when the West Irondequoit School District took their budget to voters, but did not get the 60% supermajority needed to pass. Again in June, the budget failed to pass, forcing the district to go to a contingency budget that included the cancellation of programs and 18 layoffs. Superintendent Jeff Crane was disappointed by the situation, but says the blame is not with voters or with taxpayers. Crane points to legislators in Albany for underfunding public education. The problem, he and others say, is related to cutbacks in funding that go back 4 years. The gap elimination adjustment was a budget-cutting measure taken by lawmakers to keep the state solvent during the recession. Basically, a gap in the state budget was partially filled by money that would have gone to schools. School leaders say this has shortchanged districts to the tune of billions of dollars. In recent years, legislators have slowly replaced some of the funding, and now more than one state senator is calling to use money from a settlement with BNP Paribas toward the remainder of the funds still owed to schools. Today, we'll hear from leaders about the settlement, past lawsuits about funding, and ideas for better funding models in the future. My guests this hour are Jody Siegel, Executive Director of the Monroe County School Boards Association, Mike Pirro, the Superintendent of Pittsford Schools, Julie Christensen, the Superintendent of Kendall Central School District, and over the phone we have Rick Timms, the statewide school finance from the Statewide School Finance Consortium. If you'd like to join our conversation this hour, you can give us a call at 1-844-295-TALK, 1-844-295-8255. So this situation goes back pretty far. There was a situation with a lawsuit with the state and the Campaign for Fiscal Equity that started in the 1990s. Rick Timms, can you give us a little bit of a history about this lawsuit?
Certainly, and thank you for having me on. The lawsuit started early in the 1990s, and the idea behind the lawsuit was that the school districts in the city of New York were inadequately and inequitably funded so that a child could not receive a sound basic education. In other words, the state had really not fulfilled a constitutional obligation to fund the city school systems, the public city school systems. Over about 13 years, that suit was finally settled, and as a result, the state came up with a new formula known as the Foundation Aid Formula, and that was an attempt to provide a more equitable distribution of funds, not only for New York City, but across the entire state. The amount of that money was over $5 billion that was to be phased in over 4 years. Unfortunately, into the second year of the program, they froze the aid, and it's been frozen ever since, and the program was never implemented, thus the state has never fulfilled its constitutional obligation to fund the state's school districts.
So right now, it's my understanding the statewide five-year GEA total is more than $10 billion. Now, I was wondering, Jody Siegel, you know, what does that really mean for districts in our area?
Well, it's had a huge impact. Our local districts over the 5 years, the members of our association, have seen their state aid reduced by almost $413 million. That's $413 million of state funding that they would have received if the state didn't take this chunk of money off the bottom of the calculation of school aid. Basically, they put the frozen school aid at the top, they add in reimbursable aids and other kinds of aids that they have, and they get to a total at the bottom, and then they subtract out a big piece called the gap elimination adjustment. It was originally instituted because the state was having a recession, and they said they couldn't afford to give the schools this money. But the state is now officially out of the recession. The state's claiming they have a budget surplus, and they're funding all kinds of new initiatives, yet they're still taking this money from the school districts. And it's interesting to note that here in Monroe County, you know, everyone in the state pays taxes that go to Albany, and then Albany moves those taxes around and sends some of it back to communities. This $412+ million is money that we're not getting from Albany. So the impact of that is on our school districts. hundreds of people have been laid off. Positions have been eliminated. Programs have been eliminated. Services, sports and extracurricular offerings have been reduced. And to some degree, although districts have been exceedingly careful about raising taxes because they have the tax cap to deal with as well, there are increases in the property taxes that would never have occurred if the state were paying the districts this money that they owe them by law. So the impact's been huge. And then, you know, you have to realize on the larger economy, when our schools are $412 million short on revenue, it means people in the community are not getting business from the schools. The schools aren't purchasing things. It ripples out and affects the entire region.
So let's look at what that's going to mean right here in Pittsford. Mike Pirro, can you say what this means for your district right now?
Well, I think to keep things in perspective, it's important to acknowledge that our current state is that we're receiving less state aid today than we were in 2007. And the ramifications of that are significant. As you think about from 2007 to now, how all costs associated with running a business have increased, everything from fuel to gas to health care to retirement. So our expenditures are continuously on the increase while our revenue is on the decrease. I can't think of the last time we've increased or added a program to Pittsford since 2007. And right now, and in the near future, we will be at the point where we need to make really tough decisions relative to program or potentially having to exceed the tax cap.
Have we had any layoffs?
We have tried to do our layoffs through attrition to the extent possible.
Okay. Now, what does that mean, Superintendent of Kendall Schools, Julie Christensen, what does that mean for your district?
Kendall's a little different. We're considered a high-need rural district, so taking that perspective, about 60% of our state aid, or 60% of our budget is relying upon state aid. So we've lost $5.5 million over the course of the last few years. For us, that's about 12% of our state aid that we've lost. In a $14 million budget, $5.5 million is significant. So like Mike, we've had to do some things looking at reductions, pulling back in programs and services to some degree. Some of it may be enrollment dictated. A lot of it is due to state aid reductions, purchasing less supplies, holding off on needed repairs in our school building.
Yeah, so when I've spoken to each of you before, Rick Timms over the phone, you were saying that rural districts and low-income districts are really being hit the hardest by this. Can you explain?
Well, certainly. When the GEA, the Gap Elimination Adjustment, began, what they did is they actually took money back from the districts who needed it the most. State aid was based in the beginning of the new foundation aid formula on trying to provide the districts that needed it most with the most amount per child in order to help them, because they certainly didn't have the fiscal capacity to take care of this themselves, and it was a constitutional obligation. So when he instituted the cuts, they simply took the money back from the people who needed it the most. So the high needs districts, the low wealth districts, those districts that have low incomes, have high numbers of kids on free and reduced lunch programs and so on, bore the brunt of the gap elimination adjustment since its inception. And it continues on today. We find that many high-need districts are still losing the most amount per child out of these state aid cuts.
And this has led to a new lawsuit that deals with equity and state funding. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. We've got a new lawsuit. We're the Statewide School Finance Consortium, and other groups are parties to the new lawsuit based on the New York's students' rights activities. And what we're trying to say is that the state has got to live up to its constitutional obligation to fund these schools. Now, right now, the cuts cumulatively are over $1 billion as we speak right here today. And these have cumulatively been almost $10 billion. Additionally, the foundation aid formula that was frozen, in order to make that right, they'd have to come up with another $4.5 or $4.6 billion. So we're closer to $5 or $6 billion in arrears in payments to schools. Now, we understand that the state is strapped, but we believe they can do other things to save money. But they have a constitutional obligation to fund these schools, and that matter has been settled. So we're going back to court to make sure that is being enforced, and that the state actually pays for that. Additionally, we're asking for an injunctive relief if the state there's really no reason for a gap elimination adjustment. So those are two legal activities that are occurring right now.
So we're talking about lawsuits, but then also we have certain state senators that are talking, more than one, that are talking about replacing some of the funding from the GEA that is missing. And we're going to go to an interview, a portion of an interview that I had with Democratic State Senator Ted O'Brien.
What I'm concerned about is that local public education has suffered from a cutback in state aid several years ago called the GEA, which stands for the Gap Elimination Adjustment. And essentially what that was the state saying, look, we've hit this recession, and we're going to solve our budget deficit by taking money away from public education. That has resulted in local school districts being very much at odds with property taxpayers, particularly in a property tax climate. And we wouldn't have that same level of tension between property taxpayers and local school boards if the state aid was even at the level it was, say, going into the 2010 budget year. And that's because we've never fully restored. Each year we've increased funding to education since I've been in the Senate, but never to the levels we were in 2010. We now have a unique opportunity with the settlement with this bank, PNB Paribas, which is going to bring a lot of money to New York to the tune of about $3 billion. And my sense is that we got to use this this source of money to eliminate this gap elimination adjustment, this lack of funding that we took from public education several years ago, and fully restore it with this windfall that we're receiving.
You mentioned that you've got the support of your fellow Democrats, but you know, many Republicans are also saying that they want to take care of this situation with the Gap Elimination Act. How do you cross over and work with them when many of them are pointing the finger at Democrats for causing the problem in the first place?
Well, you know, I don't think it's fair to say that Democrats caused the recession. That's a little out of hand. Democrats have advocated very strongly for restoration of this GEA and the lack of funding for public education. And I am encouraged to understand that some Republicans see the importance of doing that to bolster public education and to give property tax relief to upstaters. And I'm confident that we can get better funding for public education passed in the Senate.
And we can do that working with both parties?
I believe that this is one area where we can agree on. In past budget cycles, I would have liked to seen a fuller restoration more quickly. That hasn't happened, but we restored about $1 billion last year. Unfortunately, that wasn't near the amount of the total gap elimination, which we've been working towards eliminating each year in the budget cycle, but we're not where we need to be in terms of funding that school districts are enjoying as recently as 5 years ago.
Now, Mike Pirro, you have a smile on your face. I wonder if you think that this, you know, settlement plan that they have with the BNP Paribas, that's really, it's not related to schools, but it's funding, it's a windfall of money that goes to the state. You know, will that help you if they take care of that piece?
Absolutely. And I think it's something that is necessary. I think it's an ethical and legal obligation that the state has. It's an opportunity for the state to show that they truly value education. I think it's interesting when you look at high-wealth schools and low-wealth schools, how both are being squeezed from different ends. For a higher-wealth school that doesn't depend on state aid as much, is very limited in the amount of revenue they can now get from the taxpayers. Whereas the low-wealth schools are feeling the effects of the state aid much more significantly. And so all schools in New York State are feeling this crunch. And I think it's really unfortunate because for the last 3 or 4 years, schools have been highly politicized and have not been seen in a real positive light. And I think there's an opportunity here to, at minimum, begin to mend fences and work together and reinstitute or eliminate the GEA, so that we can begin to provide children the opportunities that they need. And I think that's what's important, is it's the children that are getting lost in this equation.
Okay. Now, Jody Siegel, what can we do with this? How can we create the political will? I mean, there's one thing that I talked about in that interview is, you know, in a lot of the conversations that I've had with other people, the Republicans blame the Democrats, and the Democrats say, well, the Republicans won't come along with us for what we want to do. At the end of the day, how do you push them to come along for what schools need as far as funding?
Well, I'm hoping that ultimately legislators will look at the communities they represent and speak to the needs of their specific communities. There are legislators who are starting to speak out from both parties about the importance of addressing GEA. We're hearing more and more of this. And I think they're seeing the impact more acutely when they look at the people who elected them. It's going to be important that the public lets their legislators know that they want to see their schools providing certain kinds of programs and services, what they've come to expect, what the state needs to do if we're going to prepare our children for the future we expect them to have. There are some alarming examples around the state of where districts have had to make decisions that basically leave them academically bankrupt long before they become fiscally bankrupt. And, you know, by having to eliminate the kinds of programs that allow children to really grow their minds and bring greater learning and skills to colleges and to the careers they're going to have. No one wants to see that happen. It's going to take, you know, public outcry to their legislators, and certainly school board members and other school leaders need to make it very clear to their legislators that this is a state issue that goes beyond party.
Rick Timms on the phone. We spoke before over the phone about this situation of political will, that everyone says that they want this, that they want to reinstate funding, but it hasn't happened yet. How would you chime in?
Well, I think one of the things that we've got to keep in mind is that we're all in favor of eliminating the GEA immediately, completely immediately. But there has to be a plan. Right now, this money from this bank settlement, first of all, when is that money arriving to the state? So we don't know that. Second thing is what's the plan? I mean, is there a bill? Do these senators in both parties have a bill that's going to solve this problem? Is there a long-range plan? Is there an accompanying bill in the Assembly as well as the Senate? That's how laws get passed. So they've got, in other words, we've got to get past rhetoric, and they've actually got to come up with a long-range plan. Otherwise, this will be a one-shot use of money by the state that really will not solve the GEA. It could go away one year and be back the next. So I think what we've got to do is we really need parents and the business community and stakeholders and taxpayers to work in concert with their school district leaders to ensure that the state representatives understand how serious of a problem this is and that they act accordingly with a long-range plan to finally eliminate this entire problem, to distribute the money equitably, to make sure it's sufficient for what the school districts need, and also to make sure that this whole plan is sustainable. Now, the interesting thing that was pointed out by one of your speakers is that wealthy districts have hard times, too. You would be hard-pressed in your viewing area, your listening area, to find a wealthy school district. Now, I know this is going to be hard to believe, but the wealthiest school district you have in your entire listening area is 3.3 above the average wealth of a school district in the state of New York. In your viewing area, you do not have a wealthy school. School districts in the state of New York 50 times wealthier than your wealthiest average school district there. And they are getting the state aid, and they are getting a lion's share of their GEA reduced at the expense of other districts. So please be clear, in your entire viewing or listening area, you do not have a wealthy school district, despite what people may think.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about the situation in Western New York being very different than other parts of the state. We have a listener on the line who wants to chime in on this conversation, and that is Jane. Jane, you're on Connections.
Yes, there was an opinion piece by David Sirota a couple of weeks ago, maybe a week ago, just about this issue of cutting the public services, pensions, and personnel, teachers, and the money, because there was no money, being given over to building new stadiums and repairing stadiums and building things. It's as though suddenly there was money. And in our own local paper, let's see, this was on Thursday, July 24th, it talks about on the front page an arena in line for a makeover, which it will take $38.5 million at the Blue Cross Arena. You have to read the whole article because it details what will go for the various stadiums that we already have. So the theory of David Sirota is that we're taking from pensions and from education, we're always so poor when it comes to that, and handing it over to professional sports teams, NFL, subsidies for the NFL. So if you can live with that, I congratulate you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Would you like to respond to Jane's comment?
Sure.
Jody Siegel?
I think the matter of priorities is a huge issue. And often it comes down to lobbying, that there are advocates for many different things going to Albany. And school board members don't go with money. I mean, they go and they talk about what we need for the future. It's an argument that's based on developmental needs of children. And we know there are people making arguments for other purposes. It's always a challenge. And I think one thing I'm very aware of is the importance of having elected leaders recognize how essential supporting public education is in our community, in our state, in our nation. Mike referenced that things about public education have become politicized in recent years, and they really have in a way that's alarming to people who've been involved with public education for a long time. There's been a battle going on this year between the Board of Regents, who used to function pretty much isolated, making education policy in the state, and legislators stepping into their turf and major disagreements about what to do with education in our state. Jean is right that this is a matter of concern. I think education's extremely important. I've given my life to this. But it is. This is about our future, and to the degree that stadiums are essential and about the future, you can have a big argument over that. People need to know their legislator, let their legislators know what they want.
Thank you very much. We've been speaking about school funding and the increasing politicization of we've been talking about school funding and more politics involved in such. That's here on Connections. I'm Michelle Faust, in today for Evan Dawson. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 844-295-8255, 844-295-TALK. And we're going to take a very quick break. You're listening to member-supported public radio, AM 1370, FM 91.5, HD2 in Rochester, or FM 89.5 in the Finger Lakes. Coming up in our second hour of Connections, dating and domestic violence. It's a problem that crosses all socioeconomic and geographic boundaries, but it's rarely discussed publicly. We'll talk about the danger, the myths, what you can do, and where to find help locally. It's all coming up in our second hour of Connections.
In Sarajevo, two women meet by chance in a stairwell. One survived the Holocaust, the other the Balkan War. They connect across generations.
We are the people who know what the war is and we know what the peace is, and that we should talk about the peace.
Women of different decades on what it means to live through war. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
And you've been listening to Connections. I'm Michelle Faust, hosting today for Evan Dawson. My guests this hour are Jody Siegel. She is the executive director of the Monroe County School Boards Association. Mike Pirro, the superintendent of Pittsford Schools. Julie Christensen, the superintendent of Kendall Central School District. And over the phone, we have Rick Timms of the Statewide School Finance Consortium. If you'd like to join us, 844-295-8255, 844-295-8255.
talk. We're talking about school funding this hour, and we had a quick chat, Mike, you and I, before we came on the air, and you had talked about part of the problem is that you can't make plans for the future. And I know that when you're looking at curriculum and you're thinking about the different things that are changing in the schools, you know, teachers are always making plans. If the administrators can't make the plans, what does that mean?
It's extremely important to be able to have a process for long-range planning and being able to plan 4 to 5 years out so we can be very thoughtful and deliberate with our funds and be responsible and respectful to our residents. And I think part of this, the whole process that's concerning, if we go back to the start of Campaign for Fiscal Equity, one of the byproducts of that was for districts to be allowed to have the amount of aid up front so they would know what they were going to receive for 4 years down the road. That would then indeed allow districts to look at priorities in their budget and be able to plan 4 years out. In our current state, as we enter into next year, we absolutely have nothing written in stone relative to the amount of aid that we're going to receive next year. We're in limbo relative to the GEA. We're in limbo relative to the foundation aid. And we're in a climate now where it's pretty demoralizing as we start each year thinking about, well, if we get $250,000 less this year, where are we going to cut? If we get $500,000 less, where are we going to cut? Instead of having the mindset of looking at many of the other state initiatives that are also unfunded. So if the state is asking us to deliver high-quality instruction and meet college and career readiness through the Common Core standards, or if the governor is asking for an evaluation process for teachers and administrators that's of the highest quality, but those are priorities at the state level, yet districts are left to fund them. So not only do we not know what we're going to be receiving in aid, I can share that at minimum, we've spent over $250,000 on both unfunded mandates in a 2-year window.
Yeah. And so what does that mean for you, Julie Christensen, in Kendall, when you have to make decisions and you've got to make plans? And I mean, I wonder, what was the last time you were able to plan a few years into the future?
It's been a while. A few years back when they had the stimulus funds, we received that well after our budget was developed in the fall. And so you receive what they would indicate as a windfall of money, but it's beyond time where you can be thoughtful and planful on professional development. If there's a program that you want to begin or initiate, you've lost that summer to do so. And so to echo Mike's sentiments, it's really helpful to have that information up front. If Kendall was to receive the $5.5 million that we've lost, I would want to be really thoughtful on what that would be to provide that service to our students and to our community, because we are the biggest employer. So I think it's a community effort. It's a conversation we need to have to help our children be college and career ready, as well as our families. The social equity piece is an element of that as well, providing those services for our community in a way that makes sense.
It sounded to me like when you were talking, Mike, that when you're looking in the future, really you're looking at what can I cut? And I wonder, Rick Timms, do you see that as something that we're seeing at schools and districts across the state?
Yes, we are. Matter of fact, what we're finding out is people are running out of things to cut. It's been said many times that the student who walked across the stage to receive their diploma last June may have gotten the best education most school districts will be able to offer for the foreseeable future, and that things are going downhill from there. What we've got to realize here is there's been a shifting burden. State government has been proud to say that we have balanced our budget, the state budget, for the last 4 years, and we have eliminated our deficits. Well, guess how they did that? They did that by withholding aid from school districts and municipalities. So technically speaking, that $10 million deficit, we've made up for that $10 million deficit with $10 billion worth of cuts. $10 billion deficit, $10 billion worth of cuts. And so what happens is we don't know what the future looks like. I mean, there's a lot of ideas for one-shots and let's do it this way and let's do it that way. But I think Mike's got a point, and so is Julie, in a sense that where do we go from here? We're not educators because we want to see the demise of a system to help children. We want to make sure that we help children into the 21st century. It's a new world out there. The high school education is just the beginning of their careers. So we've got a lot of planning to do, but we don't have a lot of assistance because we don't know our revenues.
Rick, I appreciate your comment of being at the point where we're running out of things to cut. And I think that what's really interesting today is that districts have now find themselves in a very precarious position. Many districts in Monroe County are at the point where if they want to stay under the tax cap and they're not getting additional funds owed to them via GEA, then it's program that has to go. And when you begin to cut program, you begin to not have students have the opportunities that you would expect in Monroe County, let's put it that way. That angers the citizens and the residents who are going to be hopefully supporting your budget. And so you can see this vicious cycle of walking that fine line between the lack of funding. Do we go for a supermajority? And the stakes are so high, what if that doesn't work? And my biggest worry is that the very people that we serve, which are our residents and community members, have expectations that we can no longer meet in the event funding is not available.
So we have some callers on the line that would like to chime in on this. I'm going to go right now to Bonnie on line one. Hello, Bonnie. You're on Connections.
Yes, hi. You know, the comment about taking the politics out of this, I think everyone, at least that cares about these things, is would like that to happen. I sure would. However, the reality is when you deal with funding, no matter, you know, what kind it is, it's of course necessary to run the system, is you're going to get into politics and, you know, because people allegedly express themselves through politics, voting or not voting or whatever. I think the thing here, when you talk about what do we do next and the funding, I would love to see more attention paid to those politicians and others who are urging us to really look at the funding in the sense of the need to return to much more progressive income tax. I mean, property tax, whether you can totally, eliminate it is, of course, a big question, but you might not want to do that, but it's, most people feel there's too much dependence on property tax. So candidates who have positions, even though they may seem difficult to achieve, we keep avoiding the obvious, and that is if we don't have funding and we're not using the level of progressive income tax that we should be doing, if you compare recent history going back a number of years, it was much higher, especially after the war and all that, to do what they had to do. We are not going to ever achieve this, and it's going to be Band-Aid after Band-Aid after fight after fight after, after disappointment after disappointment. But there's one, as your speaker said, these are things for the future, and that's going to mean changes, and that's when you make changes, you have to often put in more money to do that. So we're really in mind. So I would like to see attention paid in the media to having people come forth who can present other support for this progressive income tax. I, of course, support Howie Hawkins, who's running for governor under the Green Party, but it's not just about supporting one person. It's about changing the way we do things. And until people realize that that's what has to happen, I'm not just saying this for cliche's sake, this is what has to happen, we're never going to get beyond this kind of discussion. So thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Now, Rick Timms, do you think a progressive income tax or some other change in taxing models to help schools is the solution?
Well, it's certainly something to look at. The dilemma you have with the income tax is if we look at the last recession, the problem was is that everybody's income fell away. Therefore, there was less to tax, but their property stayed intact. It could still be taxed, and assessments didn't change much. So we see the volatility in the income tax with the economic climate. The other thing, too, is we got to equalize the tax across the entire state. You've got to understand here, too, that what's actually happening is that we have a very diverse state of New York. And so what happens is maybe a sales tax or a user tax, people have also talked about, rather than just property taxes. So we have some communities where the property is it's worth a lot of money, but the income isn't so great. And we see a lot of places where the property values are a problem because the people who own the property really don't live there. It's a vacation home or a rental home or something like that. So this a single system, I think the caller has something here that's important. A single system isn't going to do it. The interesting thing, though, I think that brings the property tax into focus, though, is our property tax cap was an attempt by state government to halt the push of property taxes against taxpayers, and that's a good idea. People can only pay so much. The dilemma comes when property tax cap is put into place in the same set of years as state aid to the municipalities who rely on property tax have dwindling revenues from the state. They use the Massachusetts model. In Massachusetts, they increased actually state aid to municipalities and school districts and imposed a property tax cap higher than New York's. In New York, they made a lower property tax cap, and they cut aid simultaneously, which put more pressure on school districts. So what we have is this huge shifting of burden. Solving it by the property tax is not the only solution. It probably should take a multiple number of ways to do it, but simply going to income tax, I'm not so sure economically would work.
Jody Siegel, would you like to chime in on that?
Sure. I think Rick's right. It's changing the way the tax is collected isn't necessarily automatically going to solve the problem. It's certainly worth exploring. I know it in other decades that's been a discussion in Albany. It has never actually gone anywhere. So, and as school people, we haven't focused so much on how the state collects their taxes as how the taxes are allocated to the school districts. And what we've noticed are several things. One, regarding the tax cap, it was supposed to be a two-part change. First, they were going to impose the cap, and then they were going to address mandate relief. And not only have they not addressed mandate relief, in the years since the tax cap has passed, they have passed very, very costly mandates that have put additional obligations on school districts for how to use the funds they have. Most people will say, you know, looking at the totality of the impact of introducing the Common Core learning standards, the impact on how we evaluate people, the changes in curriculum, the testing regimen, these things have all been very costly to introduce, and although we received a small amount of money to cover it, it's been nothing compared to the expense, nothing at all. And we're adding those expenses at a time of reduced revenues, so that's a big factor for districts. As the cost of, you know, it's not as if the cost of providing education have actually gone down. New York State's share of the portion of providing education has gone down. Most states pay 50% or more of the cost of education in their states. New York is, I think, around 38%. And state mandates drive a great deal of that.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the phones right now. We have Pete from here in the city. Hello, Pete. Do you have a comment for us on Connections?
Good afternoon. Several years ago, there was a study that calculated the lost revenue from the tax cuts on the wealthy individuals in New York State. The number was around $20 billion a year. Just think of what kind of investment we could make in our future if we still had that money. But rich people needed tax cuts. How do we get that? How did they get the tax cuts? The tax cuts are achieved through lobbying, making campaign contributions to politicians who get elected and then in turn pay back those contributors for their financial support. The only way anything is going to change is we have to change the way we finance campaigns. We all have a stake in the government. We are all part of this government. We all have a responsibility to make a contribution for those campaigns. So when these politicians get elected, their allegiance isn't just to the few handful of people who finance their campaigns with thousands, tens of thousands, if not more, of dollars. They owe their allegiance to all of us.
Thank you very much, Pete. And, you know, we've already talked about that schools don't really have the money to make that lobbying effort in Albany like other lobbying organizations do.
Nor should they, might
yeah,
I add.
Yes.
You know, that's not how we're supposed to be using our public funds.
Exactly. But we're talking also about, you know, we talked about mandates, and somebody mentioned that we're in a new world of education. I think that was Rick, but you know, we're talking about new regulations of things that have to happen with the Common Core. Not to get into many details about that, but there's a cost associated to that. And there's certain changes, I'm sure, that, you know, at Kendall, you, Julie, you'd like to put some new infrastructure into your schools. And what are the costs of doing some of the things that you'd like to do for that new world education with the Common Core, with more STEM programs?
What are you lacking that you'd like to have because of this funding gap?
I think when you think about the college and career ready, STEM is a perfect example, science, tech, engineering, and math. And having those programs, having the infrastructure. So in Orleans County, we struggle with broadband accessibility, which is an issue for us as well. So we can purchase computers. We don't have the ability to run the systems that we would like to run. Looking at other engineering courses that we could offer, we certainly look at sharing some of those services and those programs with neighboring districts. And all the materials associated with running that, the professional development, so our staff feel adept at instructing in those areas. And that's just a small piece of what we would like to do when we think about all the careers that are available to students, careers that we're not even aware of, and preparing them with those critical thinking skills. There's staff development. There's resources that need to go along with that.
Now, Rick Timms, over the phone, we had a conversation before about just the basic infrastructure that many rural schools especially need, and changes need to be made that they just don't have the funding for.
That's absolutely correct. It's very difficult for rural schools or average and below average well school districts to pay for the things Julie just talked about. I mean, these things are expensive, and a lot of times the technology is changing so fast, the replacement costs are prohibitive. So one of the problems, though, we've got is that the kids in Julie's and Mike's school are going to be competing with some of the best brains and the best well-funded school districts in the state of New York that are very, very wealthy. So how do our kids compete? How do our kids get a chance? Where's the level playing field that the CFE case promised these kids for a sound basic education, that all kids would be treated appropriately regardless of their zip code? And there's the problem. The problem is that not only are the mandates gone, or the mandates still exist and nobody's actually brought relief to them, the problem is that as we head, whether it's the Common Core or the annual professional performance reviews or the in-service and staff development for the new standards or anything like that, the truth of it is more is being foisted upon the schools than the resources are actually coming from the state. So average and below average wealth districts, particularly in rural areas where there's isolation and scarcity and so on, they're going to be very hard-pressed. All these communities are. And, you know, the other thing, too, is we've unemployed about 30,000 educators in the last 5 years who all had salaries, whether they were teacher aides or teacher assistants and teachers, and, you know, that hurts the business community, too. And speaking of business, don't they invest in their infrastructure? Where's the state's investment in school district infrastructure?
Now, Mike, what are some of the needs from your district that you just really haven't been able to keep up with, things that you haven't been able to invest in because of these cuts?
First, I want to address something that Jody shared. She talked about how districts received some money to meet the requirements of the mandates, and I want people to really truly get the real picture here. What Jody was alluding to, I believe, were Race to the Top funds, and I can speak to Pittsford. We received $25,000 over the course of a 3-year period to offset the costs associated with the new reform agenda. I mentioned this before. The state gave us $25,000. At minimum, we spent $250,000. So you take the $200,000 deficit there because of an unfunded mandate. And on top of that, you add the $14 million that we've lost through GEA. You add the $60 million that we've lost collectively since 2007. And that's a lot of money that we can be using towards students. I think people keep forgetting that we're talking about politics, and instead we should be talking about kids. If we had that money now, or portions of the money, we would be talking about more 21st century new course proposals, some fresh courses if it's around nanotechnology or if it's around gaming for kids. We would think about providing kids more blended learning opportunities and mobile technology and providing internships and capstone projects and opportunities for them to collaborate. And all of these are taking the back burner because we're trying to keep our head above water. And I appreciate that we're here talking about GEA. But it's so hard to talk about GEA without talking about tax cap, without talking about tax freeze, without talking about Common Core, without talking about APPR, because what's happened is, and I'll say it again, it's been so politicized that school districts have significantly lost amount of autonomy. And we are the ones that know what's best for kids, and I firmly believe that. And unfortunately, we're not able to spend our money in the direction we feel is best for kids.
Speaking about what's best for kids, there's been a lot of conversation about pre-K and yes. more pre-K. And there's been some criticism to a certain extent of, well, schools aren't taking advantage of some funding that would be available for pre-K. But then many schools have said that's not exactly the way things work. Jody, can you talk to us about that?
Sure. The vast majority of school districts in New York State are not applying for the pre-K, full-day pre-K funds. And there are reasons for this. First, people need to realize that of the $340 million available for pre-K in the state budget, $300 million of that is for New York City. $40 million of that is for the rest of the state, which is where the majority of children are, and districts need to apply for competitive grants to have access to that money. But while the process of I won't go into the process of applying, but it involves other community agencies, and it's pretty complicated. If a district gets the money, they have to put a full-day program in place. But they won't be getting any money from the state right away. In fact, they need to forward fund the costs of the program because the first of reimbursements for the program will come in the spring and the rest in the following year. 25% will come in the spring and the rest 75% the next school year. That kind of forward funding for a full-day program where you would need space to have it and you need to have full-time employees as part of it, you know, additional transportation costs, whatever goes with offering a full-day program, is significant in a time when school districts have limited reserves because they've depleted reserves to keep maintain program while the tax cap was putting constraints on their annual budgets. It's not as if everyone has the money or the rooms to do this. On top of that, the future of the funding is uncertain. You could go through all of that outlay and find out in 2 years that the state is discontinuing that funding because there's absolutely no reason to believe it would continue. School districts have to be responsible stewards of the funds they have. And although many people, and there are, by the way, other pre-K programs in place, half-day programs around the state, these programs, the state education department really needs to figure out how to make the pre-K program funding consistent and not have multiple different levels of programming around because that only adds to the confusion. But basically, with a very short time and a complicated situation and uncertain funding and the need to forward fund, districts are not jumping forward to start this program. And you have to realize that in the end decision, all of us, the vast majority of people in New York State, are primarily the people paying for the program in New York City.
It's a very popular conversation. Our lines are lighting up. I'm going to go right now to Lucia in the city. And Lucia, welcome to Connections.
Yeah, thank you. Great show. Two quick comments for your guests. What do they think the long-term impact is going to be of the privatization of public schools vis-a-vis vouchers, you know, what that does to budgets, transfer of money, and any thoughts on, and I don't know if it happened, on the proposition to allow wealthy folks to donate and get tax credits for giving to private schools, which I understand they have a right to do. One has a right to donate his or her money as he or she sees fit, but what's going to happen in terms of the tax break that they are allowed to get? And I'm nervous. I'm a public school teacher here in a city school district, and I see it as just this constellation of issues that have what's looking to be a negative impact on public school funding.
Okay, thank you very much. As we are winding down, I'm going to go ahead and let Jody respond to that.
Yes. Very quickly, the tax credit bill did not pass, and it would have given people a dollar-for-dollar tax credit, again, in a fairly complicated way for donations. The voucher, you say the word voucher, and my hair actually stands up on end, because vouchers are about sending schools to children to private schools with state dollars. State dollars are something taxpayers want to have understanding of how they're used. Public schools have to be accountable. Private schools don't. Tax dollars shouldn't be going to schools that have no accountability to the state. There's supposed to be separation of church and state. The state shouldn't be sending money to schools for children to be taught a religion as part of their school day. 90% of children are in public schools. That's where they are, and that really needs to be the emphasis on where the state is focusing their dollars and their policies.
As we wind up, I'm going to go to Rick Timms on the phone. Can you tell me, do you feel optimistic about plans to make changes in Albany towards state funding of schools?
I don't think state government has the will or the ability to actually solve this dilemma. I think we need a separate commission of professionals who deal with this, not politicians, not bank presidents, professionals who deal with this situation in educational finance to solve it. Right now, Monroe County is owed $147 million by state formula.
Thank you very much. And we're going to have to end it there. We're back. This is Connections. And we've been speaking about the complicated world of school funding. Thank you for joining us. I'm Michelle Faust, in for Evan Dawson. This is WXXI AM Rochester, WXXI FM HD2 Rochester, and WEOS FM Geneva.